Kodiak Island. I'm on the board of directors of Koniag Corporation. I was elected to the first permanent board in 1972. My father was very active in AFN back in the old days, and of course the old days are anything pre-71. I am a banker by profession, a machinist by trade, and a fisherman by choice. And I've worked in all of those throughout my life. I grew up on the same boats at Kodiak Island. I was educated outside. I did boarding homes in reverse. The family moved out to Seattle in 1950, and I started my education in that area and finished it there. I fished from 1954 until 1965 on the Saners. I worked for Seattle First National Bank for 3.5 years before I came home in 1971, and worked for First National Bank of Anchorage for 2.5 years, 3 years. And I moved over to the Alaska Native Foundation as the executive vice president for 3 years. And when we started our own bank, I went to work for United Bank Alaska, which currently belongs to 7 regional corporations and 1 village corporation. I've been there almost 5 years. I'm a vice president, currently responsible for marketing, strategic planning, advertising, public relations, political problems, and anything else that comes up in the president's office. Today, I was asked to fill in by Willie last night at 11 o'clock, and so here I am. I thought what I'd do, I've been trying to get a handle on what's going on and where you've been and what you've covered. I've taught land claims, specifically land claims classes in Anchorage before, and I thought what I'd do today is I'm going to give you multiple choice. A, you can sleep. B, we can talk about one vote for the sleeping. We can talk about the integrative mechanisms of land claims, and we can use Kodiak as an example. Or we can talk about the mechanical processes of land claims within the corporate structures from 71 to present. Or we can talk about the corporations as they relate to the acculturation and the identity crisis that faces the Alaska Native today. So we got 4 choices. We've already had 1 vote for the sleep. We can talk about integration and acculturation vis-a-vis the Kodiak experience. We can talk about the mechanical processes that have brought the corporation to the level they are today. Or we can talk about the corporations as they represent total acculturation challenges and problems. Your choice. A, B,
B,
B. Another sleep guy in the front. Okay, here we go. A. That's a winner. That lets me off there. That's safe. Don't have to tell any lies. B.
B.
B, B. B. What's B? That's the mechanical processes of the corporation that have brought them to the level they are today. Okay, D. The regional corporations as they represent a challenge to the integrative and acculturation process that we see today. Well, it's about half B and D. Can I cover them both? Well, in that we can't decide, I'm leaving. That's it. Okay, I'll tell you what I'll do. Well, let's talk about the mechanics of the regions, 71 through present, and we'll talk about those sort of slanted as they relate to the Native identity as a statewide. I'll try and blend it a little bit. Okay? You've had lots of history, lots of crap about the Russians and all that junk and bored you to death, so you're up to the level of 1971. One thing we need to establish, and that's why 1971. Can anybody summarize what you've learned today on why 1971? Why 1971?
Oil.
Oil. Definitely one facet of why 71. You study the Organic Act, 1884. The Organic Act said, Section 8, We recognize in the fact that the natives own the land, there's no question of title. However, we reserve the right to settle a question of such title to a later date. You're familiar with the Organic Act. That's 1884. Well, if it's mandated in 1884 that the natives in fact own title, how do you get a Tongass National Forest? How do you get a National Wildlife Refuge in Kodiak? Isn't that trespass? Why 1971? Very important to establish 1971. Mandated in 1884. It's mandated in the Treaty of Session, if you really want to go into there. The Russians were far more benevolent towards an ethnic identity than the Americans ever were. Western philosophies of assimilation, migration versus Eastern philosophies. That's an interesting paper if you ever want to do it. Why does Western Europe take over a minority and create a minority enclave as opposed to how the Eastern philosophies assimilate the minority? If you look at Russia today, all it is minorities. It's ethnic enclaves. And they have schools in all the different languages. How does that happen? What's the mentality required for that? It's very interesting because it plays an important role in land claims because of the Treaty of Session. But let's start with the Organic Act. Oil is part of the answer. Another one of the answers are Nates. We're weird. Indians don't like Aleuts, Aleuts don't like Eskimos, and Eskimos don't like anybody. We don't get along. We never got along. There are people living in the Kuskokwim that can take you out and show you where their grandfather was killed by the people from the Yukon. There are people in Glen Allen that can remember being hidden by their grandparents from the slaving parties of the Tlingits coming up to Copper River. I can take you to islands that were used as fortresses where my people would flee the village to climb up on the rocks to be safe. We didn't get along. Why didn't we get along? Same reason the black people didn't get along with the Sioux, the Kiowa didn't get along with the Cherokee, Seminoles didn't get along with anybody. You're talking about a huge area, a huge mass, very tremendous problems with communication, very limited trade routes, very low technology of communication. And that's very important why 1971. Our people did not talk to one another. Our people didn't get together till they got to Chamawa and Etchkim. And when they got to Etchkim, they stood in little groups and looked at one another. That's what Grandma said to watch out for. I'm not kidding you. Really, seriously. The Indians in Etchkim went with the Indians and they played basketball. And the Eskimos made cheerleaders. They didn't intermix, and it took many, many years. Finally, because of those policies, and because of those intermixing, and the people start to talk. Consequently, in the late 50s, the early 60s, you have this attitude of, Jesus, there's really a similarity between all of us. We really have the same problems. My problems in Tanunik are very similar to your problems in Akiak. Gee, we've got some of the same words. I thought you guys were Aleuts. No, we're Koniagnutes. And these kind of interfaces started to develop. Technology dictated that it would not happen until the people could talk to one another. They could find some comfort level. So it wasn't going to happen in the 40s. It wasn't going to happen in the 30s. Anybody try and call a village yesterday? Hard, still. One phone, party line. You ever heard of a 400-person party line? Call Tanunik. It's still very, very, very difficult. So, one of the reasons 1971 and not 1884 is the people didn't know who we were and we didn't get along. Economics played a role. You can't go to Washington as a native and get anything. It's just not enough. America works on dollars. America is a capitalistic system. And it's only when the system is threatened or the system can be enhanced to the betterment of a given group that wheels start to happen. Boom, boom. Things fall. Things happen. The Organic Act said that Congress reserved the right to settle it. That excluded a judicial settlement. Very much so. So,
Udall slaps a land freeze on Alaska. In the late 60s, middle 60s, you got this area up here, you got oil. You notice the only blue land up here, the only patented land. You ever wonder about that? It isn't over here in Noatak. See, people have been living there for 3,000 years, but there's no patented land there. But right here, where nobody's ever lived, it's all patented. It has a title. The subsurface estate can be sold. It was sold at auction. The oil's there. But they got to get the oil out. Udall says, hey, 1884, 1968, 67,
gee, you've had reasonable time, Congress, to settle this title question. No more land changes hands in Alaska. I'm putting a land freeze on Alaska until you settle the land claims issue. Now you've got economics in the ballgame.
The oil comes to play. And it's not the oil. It's the profits. The oil is the catalyst for the dollars that represent the profits. And it's the profits. It's the jeopardy of profits that forced the industry to Washington. They put him in bed with the natives. Strange bedfellows. Now we've got the oil companies ripping off the reservations on one hand, and on the other hand, they've got a wheelbarrow full of money. Not a pocketful, I mean a wheelbarrow full of money and their arm around the Alaska native in late 1960s saying, let's get you your land. Really what he's saying is, I can't make a buck till you get yours, so let's take care of you first. So you've got the economics involved and the profits threat. You've got people talking to one another. And you've got some magic ingredients. There's a magic man named Emil Noddy that can actually bring all these people together and sit them down at a table and keep the tone level. So you've got leadership. Magic leadership. So in state you've got all the ingredients in 1971, and it physically could not have happened before 71. Would have been impossible. Your grandmother couldn't have settled it. My grandfather couldn't have been involved. The technology wasn't there. The leadership wasn't there. The trust wasn't there. And definitely the economics weren't there. And there's only one more ingredient you need to have a settlement. The recipient third party. You need somebody in a receptive mood. Here's Congress. Congress is in a receptive mood, you know? What's happening? What's going on? 68, 69, 68, 67. Watts is being burned down. We're shooting people at Kent State. We're in a war that's not very popular, to say the least. There's riots in Newark. The black community saying, God damn it, I've had enough. Enough. I'm going to blow this country right out of the water. We're right on the verge of anarchy. We think about it. You know, American historians kind of glaze over it. Think about the headlines back in 67, 68, 69. If those headlines were coming out of Hungary or Yugoslavia or Cuba, the propaganda machine in America would be saying, the country's coming apart, they're killing students in the park. You know, it's right on the verge of anarchy. The country's really, really unstable. Congress is running scared. Congress has got serious problems. Our elite are defecting. We don't use that term in America. We have deserters who go to Canada. How is that different than defection? That's exactly what it is. They're leaving the country for political reasons. Americans are applying for asylum in Stockholm. The country's unhealthy. Congress is really uneasy. And in walks the Alaska Native. Pure white, virgin, never had a treaty, never been ripped off or anything. And Congress is saying, damn, let's do this one right. They're really in a receptive mood. They don't want to peek us off. They really want to treat us right. They want to show us how great the country is, and the reservation system doesn't work, and we're going to change things. And it's a new day, and God, it's clean. They don't have to undo any legislation. They've got a congressional mandate carrying over from 1884. So you've got a very receptive Congress. Does anybody here think that you could put the same bill through in 1980? You could never do it. You could never put that bill through today. Can't be done.
Timing was absolutely vital to what came out. Now, what came out?
It's the most concise piece of ambiguous legislation to come out of 71 since the recession. Absolutely. Without a doubt. Senator Saylor said that. Well, what is the Land Claims Act?
If there is one historic fact about land claims that is absolutely the most important thing, if you were going to put one sentence in a history book about Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, what would you say? What would you say? What would you say? What would you say? You hit it right on the head. Different.
The deviation of a congressional norm. That is the significant thing. 150 years from now, that's how it will start. Congress deviated from a 200-year tradition. There's been 572 land claim settlements in America.
The Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act was 573. Ours only misses one word to make it like all the rest, and what's that? Treaty. That's all it is. It's just a treaty.
What is the traditional settlement? Simple. A big R. Very nice piece of real estate. Set up in perpetuity. Complete with educational, health facilities, housing, and general store. Reservation. In exchange for that, you give up your nomadic ways, you live within those boundaries, you live by the rules of the Great White Father from Washington, who from time to time changes the rules. And that's the system. Now, in theory, that's not too bad. You don't have to work. You don't have to hunt. Your kids get educated. You never need to worry about medical assistance.
You got a store. You get an allotment every year. If you're inclined to, you can farm. New pickup truck every 4 or 5 years.
That's not a bad system. Anybody here want to go? But where does it fall down? You know, the system doesn't work because it's un-American. What is the American way? What are all the values? What are all the... I mean, if you pick out an example of a man today, an American, and you always wanted to be like him, what has he done? Why do you pick him out? Why do you identify with him? Made it on his own. Sure, Wally Hickel, good example. I don't agree with his philosophies. But you can't deny the man was great. Came into the state with 72 cents in his pocket and a borrowed train ticket, right? We've heard the story many times, and we know a lot of men, and you can name a lot. But they're American, and they made it in the American system. How does that fit? Where is that man in there? I can't find him. In fact, this guy's lifestyle is exactly on the other end of the scale.
The SOB doesn't have to work. He's on the dole. His kids get whatever they need.
Is that a guy you look up to? He's exactly on the other end of the scale. And beyond that, he doesn't have to learn English. He doesn't have to learn any of the skills necessary to compete. He's isolated, segregated, looks funny, dresses weird. There's nothing about that man that's American, except that he's the only American here and everybody else is an immigrant.
If you study land claim settlement in Alaska and you use this as an exact negative example, if you always bear in mind the acid test of any question about land claims is that the way it is on a reservation? And if the answer is yes, it's exactly opposite in land claims. What this system produces is a segregated individual who's a non-conforming being. In no way is there any similarity between him and anything in the real world. Now, Congress says we can't perpetuate this system as though they just woke up, they said, my God, it doesn't work. Let's not perpetuate it. So we've got to come up with a system that's exactly opposite. And if there's one term about Alaska land claims that's very important, is its integration. The only thing left out of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act is native. There's nothing native about it. The only thing native in the act is the enrollment. You read the thing, you go through it, native isn't in there. Native value isn't in there. Native culture, native village, native anything isn't in there. Corporation, that's what's in there. That's exactly 180 degrees from this. That is America. That is the epitome of the American system. That is the final success strata. You know, the plumber that comes out of apprenticeship school, and he works his tail off, and he really does well, and he learns all his skills, and he becomes a foreman very early, and then he strikes out on his own, and he sets up a plumbing shop in his garage, and he has a sole proprietorship,
JB Plumbing Company.
And pretty soon he's got more work than he can do, so he takes in a partner. And for 3 years, JB Jones and JB Smith do business. And then the partnership's too big and it's just too much and everything, so they incorporate this disinterested third thing that can act in the capacity of a person, a corporation. It's formed, and that's the ultimate success level. You get all the tax benefits and gosh, it's just, that's America. That's growth, boom, boom, boom. Well, if you're gonna integrate, why not integrate there? I contend that Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act is economic integration. It's exactly what it is. And it is without a doubt the social experiment of this century. A fascinating experiment. Can you take an ethnic identity and integrate them economically as opposed to socially? That's what land claims is all about. Economic integration. It is exactly 180 degrees from the reservation system. It was patterned after the reservation system. The product of the reservation system is the negative example that was the congressional goal for the corporate structure. Now, how do you deal with that? That's where we are today. We're 10 years into the land claim. How do you deal with it? Okay. Let's talk about the mechanics of how it was set up. There are some really neat things about it. There are some things that are absurd. And there's just a lot of fascinating ambiguities and lots of middle ground. Lots of gray country to cover. Alaska is comprised of, depending on who you are and what point of view you have, anywhere from 5 to 7 ethnic groups. There's Tsimshian, there's Haida, Tlingit, Athabaskan, Aleut, Yupik, Inupiat, and then there's subgroups of each one. Like I say, depending on who you are and where you are from, it depends on how you count. Basically, they did one thing very neat, I think, is they let the people identify themselves and they let the people draw their own lines. That's important. Any time in the past history of the state and the people, Somebody else drew the lines. They said, you're on this side and you're on that side. And, you know, Sheldon Jackson, which is one of my real pet peeves.
He and the Pope were the only two guys and had the audacity in the New World to divide the thing up between the churches. You ever wonder why the mouth of the Yukon is all Catholic, you know, and Kodiak is Baptist, the Presbyterians are up here and the Friends are here? Sheldon Jackson, early 1870s. I envision him sort of like a mosquito in a nudist colony. He died and went to heaven and he just doesn't know where to start. You know, there's all these heathens and all this conversion to do, and the guy just must have been so excited about it, but he realized very early that there's no way that he could convert all those people. So he had a meeting. True story. 1874. Had a meeting, Sitka, and they divided her up. And the Episcopalians are in the Upper Yukon, and the Jesuits are down in the mouth, and the Moravians are out here, and the Friends are up here, and the Presbyterians and Baptists, I think, are up here, the Baptists are here. It's really interesting. My family's from a small village called Yuzinki, and the Baptists got Yuzinki. But what they didn't figure on is the Russian Orthodox had already been there for 100 years. They came in 1922, very late, and they built a really nice mission, really nice mission. And they've been really active, and they've got two converts already. Yeah, they're going huckle-buck there, boy. I tell you, they're quick. But that's Sheldon Jackson, anyway. The Nates drew their own lines. Basically, you've got a split between Nupia and Yupik. There's Yupik and Aleut in this area, both. Koniag Butte by itself, Tlingit Haida, Athabascan, Inupiat. Interesting, the Inupiat broke into three groups, mostly I think because of political identities. Nana was very active in the early days. They had a lot of really strong leadership, and they kind of identified by themselves. As easily or not, you could have had Bering Straits and Nana together. They're all the same people, basically. But they broke. And the slopes by and there were some adjustments on the lines. For instance, the people in Chignik, right here, are Koniag Butte people. They're not Aleut. And there's used to be lots of intermarrying between the villages. And they originally were put in the Koniag area. But they said, no, we really don't want to be in the Koniag area. We decided among ourselves that we want to belong to Bristol Bay. Kodiak said, fine, okay. No contest, fine, you want to go that way. So they did, they changed. Cantwell is another one. Take a look at this. Is Ruby John. Is anybody here from Cantwell area? There's a lady down there, Ruby John, just tougher than nails. Just, boy, I'm telling you, that is really tough. She said, I'm not going up there to Doyon to be gabbled up by all those river dwellers. She said, no way, Jose. I'm going down here with Otna. So there's this little tiny corridor. It goes about 40 miles up here. And there's Cantwell, and that's down in this region. And then the Tlingits, in true fashion, got in a fight with a neighbor. And they fought over this Icy Bay area. And finally, Congress had to draw the line for them.
I mean, you got to draw the line sometime, right?
So, but basically, the people decided where they were going to be. And that made up your 12 regions. That's how they were formed. That's interesting that you've got a monetary and a land-based settlement. And the people are saying identity is more important than equality of dollars. That's very interesting. We've got a little tiny region, Otna, with just over 1,000 shareholders. And you've got Sea Alaska with 14,000. I mean, you don't have to be an economics major to see the significance if it's a per capita cash distribution. You know, the numbers just are so astronomically different. And the people said, identity is more important than dollars. And this manifests itself later on in the Act in some amendments, too. Very interesting.
un-American completely. They didn't have enough bankers, is the thing. So early enough. If I'd been there. No. So he came out with 12 reasons. Let's talk about those now.
You ever heard your grandfather talk about the chief of his region? Foreign concept. No such thing as a region. No such thing as a total homogeneous ethnic tribe. New concept. Came out of the political awareness. Came out of the lobbying effort. You had to band together to speak. You couldn't possibly speak individually. There's 200 villages. Each village couldn't possibly have a meaningful voice. So they formed these groups, Kodiak Area Native Association, Northwest Area Native Association, Kenitzi Indians of Alaska, Tanana Chiefs. These units came out of the political lobbying. And a region really has its birth back in the middle of the century. You know? And really, that's a political settlement. That settlement is really Congress's dealing with this political identity. Very new concept. Has no foundation in tradition at all. Which brings up the next level. There's actually three levels of settlement. You had to settle with the politicos. I mean, they're the guys pounding the table. That's the 15 to 20 guys that are in Washington, D.C., in the late 60s, early 70s. So you got to settle with those folks. And that's how the regions were born, literally. They're the carryover of the perpetuation of self created through these associations that today are called the nonprofits. The nonprofits gave birth to the region. The administrations moved in mass over to the region because that's where the paying jobs were. Left a big void through the early 70s that were filled in about 74, 75, 76, and today are the spawning grounds for leadership moving over into the regions again. But this really, the regional corporation is really a political settlement. I can't stress that enough. Because the real settlement came with the tribe, and I totally dislike that term in Alaska. It just doesn't fit. Even the Indians we have here were not tribes, they were nations, like the Chilkat Nation of the Tlingit Indians. But you have to, I guess, deal in those terms. And the tribe in Alaska is really the village. When you get right down to the unit, the homogeneous, really the interrelative unit, is really the village. That's really where it's at. That's working Alaska natives. That's the unit. I always consider anybody that wasn't village born and village raised and didn't live in a village is a peripheral native, really. He missed something. He isn't quite whole. That village guy really knows what it's all about. And unless you've got that background, I don't know. In my region, I don't think anybody could ever be the chairman of the board of Koniag who doesn't have village credentials.
So there's 200 plus villages. Now we're getting down to the real settlement.
So we're going to create corporate structures within that unit too. And every American land claim settlement has always had one ingredient.
Spending money to the Indians. Now, whether you're Ogallala Sioux or whatever you are, when there's a settlement, you got a pocket full of money and you go out and get drunk and buy a new Cadillac. So Congress says we gotta give our Indians some money. So magnanimously, they made 10% of the first 5 years appropriations available to the individuals. Anybody remember getting your checks those first 5 years? There, most of you guys probably were still under 18 and you didn't get your check. I got mine. I was really excited. I got the first 3 years all at once, $175.
Didn't know what to do with it. I called my broker right away. I make fun of it, but actually it was a great... it's unfortunate that it came when it did, because the pipeline boom was so dominant in the economics here. But really what it did is it put about 10 or 11 million bucks directly mainstream into the economy. Remember when Ford proposed that we have a $50 tax rebate to everybody in America? And this would just really excite the economy because all this money would just sweep through the consumer. Well, in effect, that's exactly what you did in Alaska with land claims. Is you put 175 bucks out in 70,000 people's hands. Now, I don't know what you do with 175 bucks, but boy, I spend it. I mean, what do you do with $175? It don't make a down payment on anything. Actually, the true story is I matched my dad because I wanted a gun and I lost. He bought the gun. He keeps telling me that he's going to live forever and I'll never get that gun. So there was some money that went out. And totally, it was about $375 over 5 years. It was good for the Alaskan economy, and it gave the native community some identity, and they had some spending money, and in small towns it made a big impact, and it was important. But basically, the settlement took place right there. 12 regions, 200 villages. Now, there was 962.5 thousand. Am I going over stuff you've already had, by the way? Mm-hmm. 962.5 thousand cash settlements. As a native and as a corporate leader, I prefer to call that an indemnity payment. That's really the money that we paid the native community for the land that couldn't be returned. That's the blue areas on this map, and the brown areas on this map. All of those areas are technically in trespass according to the 1884 Organic Act. Anywhere there was a native family that had a fish camp, anything, a village, whatever, all of those are in violation. And of course, I have a special hatred, inbred, for the Kodiak Island Wildlife Refuge. See, the Kodiak bear came out a whole bunch better than the Alaska native on Kodiak Island. I propose someday to write a book called Treat Me Like an Animal. And what I want is I want equal rights with a bear. I figure if I had, my people had the same budget for the same amount of time, I'd be willing to give an open season for a month because I'm smart enough to go to Hawaii during that period. And we'd vacate the island. But even land claims left them short. The villages of Ashiok, Old Harbor, Carlet, Larson Bay. The government holds the right of first refusal on all lands, patented pursuant to the Land Claims Act. There's no subsurface estate within a wildlife refuge. It absolutely guarantees that those villages will never have any industrial development of any nature whatsoever, and that if for any reason those villages should fade into oblivion, the government will step in and own it, and the bear comes out. Bear? If you're a bear, it ain't a bad deal.
We had a hearing one time at home. Let me digress just a moment. I'm into one of my pet peeves. We had a hearing one time. This land over here was what they gave us to select, a like and similar nature. I don't know how you are in geography, but this has an alluvial plain that runs about 2 miles down to the beach, and from there it's all craggy mountains. I've never been there, and I don't know anybody that's ever been there. But it's of a like and similar nature to Kodiak, they say. So our villages were supposed to select there. That was fair and equitable. And we said, no, really what we'd like to do is we'd like to select at home. We really would. We'd like to select on a Frog Neck Island or some place that has some meaning to the people, and has some resources, and has a future for our people. They said, well, maybe we'd trade you. So we had this big hearing, and we said, well, they said, well, we'll trade you 2 acres in the wildlife refuge for 1 acre of this land over here. And that really sounds like a good deal. Except that the land they were going to trade us didn't have subsurface estate, and they held the right of first refusal on it. So you were trading something for nothing. And an old man in the back of the room from Kaguyak stood up
and he had a stick. And there was a bright boy from Washington. Boy, these bright boys from Washington, they're really fun. They always come up here, but he was there, and he was getting perplexed with the mentality of the natives. He really was. We were getting him down. We were dumb, and we were asking really dumb questions. This old man, you know, Alex, raised his stick up. Why do we have this bear refuge? Guy almost, you could just see him roll his eyes. He says, well, he says, it's a national treasure, he says. That belongs to all the people of America, and we need to manage it for the good of all. Oh. Well, if there was no bear, would we need a bear refuge? And the guy didn't pick up on it, and he says, well, of course not. And the old man says, well, we can arrange that. And the guy turned white, you know. I think about three winners at dynamiting dens, and we take care of the man. But be that as it may, all of that's in trespass, and the 962.5 is really an indemnity payment for those things. 40 million acres of land.
That's what the natives got. How many times have you heard that? I think that that's completely and totally wrong. That's how many we saved out of 350. We didn't get 40 million. We had claimed at 350 and we settled for 40 million. Nobody gave us 40 million acres of land. We settled for 40 million acres of land. There was never any question about our title. It's just when it was going to pass and under what set of circumstances. And every piece of major legislation you study says that, starting with the Treaty of Session, through the Organic Act, through the Statehood Act. There's never been a question about whether or not we owned it. We did not get 40 million acres of land. Settled for 40 million acres. Very, very important. Hell, if anybody had given that, IRS would have taxed it as a gift, right? IRS wouldn't miss a stroke like that. We owned it already. Now the question is, you've got a treaty, you've got some assets, you've got an indemnity price that's acceptable on both sides, you've picked a number, you've got a goal, you've identified the groups that you're going to settle with. How do you implement it? Bearing in mind now that the goal is economic integration, how do you settle it? And now we start to get into what we know today and what we've lived with for 10 years is a land claim settlement. If your goal is economic integration, you certainly can't walk up to a guy and give him $50,000. That doesn't integrate anybody. Never will. I dare say that if we gave everybody in the room here $50,000 right now today and you walked out of the room, a year from now, half of you wouldn't have any money. And 2 years from now, there'd be less than 30% with any money. And 10 years from now, almost all of you would talk about what you did with your money. It would pass. That's the nature of money. It's an exchange medium, and you would exchange it naturally. That's the function. It doesn't make you any different than anybody else. So, we've got to take this unit, and we've got to put it into an intangible instrument that has worth that you can't trade. What better instrument than stock? And I tell you what we'll do, we'll make it a non-transferable stock. Okay? What are we doing? We're capitalizing 12 corporations and 200 at this level. That's exactly what Congress did. They said, fine, now that we've got all the numbers, let's implement. We'll set up a payment schedule. We'll appropriate. We'll make the state pay their fair share, and we'll flow the money into your corporations, and we'll let your corporations seek their own level. Very important.
Let's deal just with the money now. You've got 12 regions, of which I'll put about three up there. Let's call this one Coneyag, Chelista, Otna. Let's see, Chelista, if my memory serves me right, has about 13,000 shareholders. Coneyag has 3,300. Otna has about 1.1. Okay, yeah, that's a good split. We'll capitalize on a per capita basis. And just for your notes, the regions are capitalized at a $125. But what we'll do is we'll give it to you at a prescribed rate. We won't give it to you all at once because you might blow it. And it's easy for us to pay it if we run it out. So the state or the feds came in, and of that 962.5, the feds pay 462.5. It's the federal part. State, during statehood, assumed certain responsibilities, so they're paying $500 million. Now, the state's portion is going to come out of a 2% overriding royalty on all subsurface estate. What that translates to in plain English is pipeline. The oil passing through the pipeline, there's a 2% reserve set up as a result of that, and that pays out that $500 million. Now, the pipeline originally was anticipated to become productive a little sooner than it actually did. So the Fed set up a payment schedule that looked like your traditional bell curve. They appropriated $12.5 million the first year, $35 million the second year, $50 million the third year, and $70 million for about 4 years, or 3 or 4 years running. And it paid out like this, starting at 12, 35, 50, 70. And the idea was that the state would come online with the pipeline, and it would pay, and this pays every quarter, by the way, and it would pay a lot, and it wouldn't pay much, but it would pick up dramatically as the pipeline, and these two would cross at some level close or between 50 and 70 million, not causing a major cash flow problem in the corporation 6 or 8 or 10 years down the trail. Well, what's actually happened is this came on very late, and it came on out here, but then the state just paid off. That $300 million that they paid, they just paid right off. Well, first time they had a surplus. So the state doesn't know any more money. So that was the capitalization per capita among the 12 regions. Now there's a little hooker in there. It's called a thing called a 13th region. Anybody belong to 13th region here? 13th region was a provision in the act that said if the majority of the natives residing outside of the state elect to form their own corporation at the time of enrollment, it will be done. That election failed miserably. They all opted home. Everybody that had an identity went, gee, just right back, zip, and registered back to their village. Unfortunately, during this elective process, there were several administrative units set up to represent the 13th. And once you set up an animal, it's hard to kill it. And these units vied for power, and they effectively lobbied Congress and through the court system simultaneously to hold a new election. And the court ruled that the BIA, God bless the BIA, BIA had mismanaged the election so bad that they automatically created, Judge Gash in Washington, D.C., created the 13th, and they said there will be an opt-in or an opt-out election. And this happened about 74, 75. And they finally got that ironed out. So there was a 13th region. It was created through the courts simultaneously, and it was in the first amendment to the act. So it was created in both places. So then they had an opt-in and an opt-out election. And there are about 4,000 natives residing in the 13th region. And there are some unique factors about that, and I'll explain that when we get into the land and the structures. Okay. Very simple. Per capita, 12 regions. Per capita laws at about 6625. Now, if anybody here has a calculator and they plug this number in, and they plugged it into that, they divided it by the 77,000 natives, they find it came out substantially short. Naturally, you all did that, so nobody did that? Good. Usually about now somebody's saying, hey, wait a minute, that can't be right. Actually, that only represents 50% of that number. The other 50% went to capitalized villages. What Congress did is they said, we will use the regional structure as a pass-through to the villages. And the region will capitalize each village per capita of the amount distributed equal to 50%. Boy, a lot of blank faces. Right? Follow me? Sure. Congress cut the money in half. They said half of it will go to the regions and half of it will go to the village. And it will all be distributed on a per capita basis, or per head. Each village in Alaska is capitalized as a corporation at the same rate as any other. It's all according to enrollment. But the regions had to pass through the money. Instead of the government sending each village a check, they sent one check to the region, and the region had to do all the accounting and pass the money out to the village. And a village could be anywhere from 26 people on up. There are, I think, three villages larger than the smallest region. Nome, Barrow, Bethel. I think Fort Yukon might be. It's been so long since I've looked at those numbers. So the region passed through. Now this became a very muddled area of land claims for about the first 7 years. What relationship does a region have to a village? When you take this into consideration with the birth of the region and recognizing that it's a political entity representing the whole homogeneous ethnic identity, and the village is really the roots of the identity, really the tribe, the real band, you can automatically see the major conflicts that are going to happen. Compounding that, we get into land. The land is all dual ownership. The subsurface estate to all 40, by the way, it's 43.7 million acres. All subsurface belongs to a region. There's no village that owns its oil. There's no village that owns its coal. There's no village that owns its gravel. Maybe. That one's still in court. Now, what is subsurface? Gravel subsurface? I gotta sink a shovel in it to get it. It's under the ground. Then again, if I pick it up one at a time, it's always on top. Real hair-splitting things, you know? And all of these things pit native against native, corporation against corporation, constantly in conflict. My buddy from Old Harbor, Swin Hawkins, neat old guy, crazy, crazy guy. He brings a box full of hats when he comes to a meeting. And he puts on a hat. Does anybody need to talk to the postmaster? He says, I'm here. Takes his hat off,
puts on another hat. He says, the mayor's here. You got any municipal business? Takes his hat off. Puts on his village corporation. He says, anybody got any business with a village corporation? Takes his hat off. Puts on his regional director's hat. He says, anybody got any business with a region? He says, I'm here. He says, if you want to listen, I'm a lay reader too. You know, I mean, the guys, the conflicts of interest that are dealt with in the village would drive the normal corporate executive buggy. I mean, you know, you go home babbling to himself.
And the people deal with it daily.
This constantly gets in conflict of identity. Constantly playing with games. My village. You got a problem. The dock needs repair. You've got to put in through the municipality for an EDA grant. Okay? But the traditional council has the capability of putting in certain grant funds too, and they want to get involved. So you call a meeting. Meeting convenes, 9:30. Everybody shows up, has a cup of coffee, kicks the problem around. Meeting recesses at 11:30. You go home, you talk to mama, you talk to your brother-in-law, you talk to your cousin, maybe you get on a CB and you talk to Phil who's out crabbing. And basically the village comes to a consensus of opinion on the proper solution and the best way to stack their cards to go at the problem. The meeting's reconvened at 3:30, somebody makes a motion, it carries, problem solved, recess. You don't run a corporation that way. You can't run a corporation that way. You get on the CB and you talk to your cousin Phil and you say, Phil, should we pay $285,000 for the cannery site, including tide rights, or should we let the tide rights go and buy the warehouses and the docks and lease the tide rights? And you're quoting numbers back and forth, option A, option B. While you're doing this, a third party comes in and buys the tidelands. You just breached the confidentiality of the corporation, and you're subject to a minority stockholder suit. You can't do it. You just can't share that information. The corporations are running secrecy, competitively. The corporation may have to invest in an investment that's in direct competition with a store. And a guy's been in business for 40 years. You're sitting on the board of directors and you owe the guy $600 in grocery bills and he's the only guy that's fed your kids all winter. And you're gonna run him out of business. How do you justify those things? Where do you find yourself? Where do you find your identity? If you vote no on the investment, and it's a good investment, and somebody reads the minutes and they say, what the hell's the matter with you? Boom, they vote you off the board. Really, really, really tough. Real tough problem. Some villages, the corporate structure works beautiful. Not picking on anybody, but in a Tlingit community, beautiful. It's great. Lots of conflict, lots of ambiguities, lots of rewards, lots of infrastructure struggles, lots of clan identity. There's a gold ring. You can be Byron Malott and be the chairman of the board. It all fits. It all fits within the culture. You go to Tanunik, none of that fits. None of it. Yeah, everybody has the same game rules. Everybody has the same dollars. And theoretically, everybody has the same opportunity. Success in land claims. How do you equate success? If the corporation makes a lot of money and declares a great dividend, $10 dividend per share, beautiful, send out a check for $1,000. How dramatic does $1,000 affect the life? Corporation invests in reindeer husbandry, goes broke in 44 years. 67 people have been running the administration, they've trained 411, they have a huge herd, that's divided up among the shareholders. Is that success? Corporate success, native success, integrative success, segregation success. I want to be me. This is my village. Nightmute. Nightmute doesn't want anybody there. It's a quiet village.
They speak English occasionally. They have no use for the outside world. It's the only village that still migrates annually. Goes to its summer village, Ungermuth, on the coast. Beautiful thing. People are contented. People are happy. Where's the trade? Where's the balance? Where's the success? Is it within this structure? We go back to the reservation system. Squalor. Sun comes up over the mountains. Father rolls over on a straw cot. Kid standing in the open doorway in a ragged t-shirt. And the father smiles to himself and he says, Muscalero Apache. Always. 50 years from now, can I say Koniegmuth? Where's the trade? Where's the balance? What's success? When do you advocate? When do you pull the expose? When do you say, I'm tired of the ripoff? These guys are screwing it up. I want to take it over. Look at the money they waste. Where's the trade? Delicate balance. Social experiment of the century. Social experiment of the century. What is success? Is it success to have everybody in the village educated? Is it success to have everybody, quote, working? You ever heard that term?
Oh, them guys in the village, they don't work.
How do they eat?
You carry 40 geese across 3 miles to your boat in the slough, and let me tell you, you're working. You are really working. And the sweat's running off you, and you're just really, really, really working. Where's the trade? Where's the balance? Where does land claims fit? Where does this mechanism go? Should all of our youth aspire
to be like me, vice president of a bank, you know, beautiful, wow, man, you've really arrived. Is that success? Or maybe total failure? Tough issue, huh? It's easy to lay back and look at land claims and criticize this level right here.
Look at your list, Oscar Coagley. We've lost $7 million.
They've also increased the mentality and the awareness of the overall people within the region probably threefold in 10 years. Is that good? Is that bad? Where's the trade? It's so easy to throw stones. I hear people all the time, Perry, what in the hell did you guys buy that cannery for? You should have talked to me. Those piling in that thing are no good. You're going to have to replace that whole dock. And that's the shareholder's perception of the investment. The fact that we wrote off the dock before the investment consideration was even made is irrelevant. The shareholder, to a large degree, views the regional corporation and to a lesser extent the village corporation as a multi-shareholder joint venture. I am a shareholder, I have equal rights. No, you don't. The only rights you have is you can vote in the shareholders or vote in the corporate directors. And you can vote at the annual meeting. That's the only right you have. Do you have control of your destiny?
No.
Are these regional corporations the magic formula to make the people independent, totally self-sustaining in their identity? No. Will they be successful?
I don't know.
Very, 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 very difficult to evaluate. Almost impossible. A hell of a lot of fun to watch and be a student of. Sometimes it's traumatic because you're emotionally involved and you're involved daily. But you constantly have to remind yourself, just take a step back, take a step back, take a step back.
Look at it objectively. Look at it objectively. It's impossible, but it's a constant, constant problem. Emil Nadi and Byron Malott and any of the names, any of the cliche names that you can come up with, constantly reevaluate their position. Willie, you've listened to Willie for 8 weeks. Do you know where Willie's coming from? Willie's starting to say, we can have both. We can have the best of this world, and we can have the best of our world. And he's convincing himself it's possible. And maybe it is. I'm less convinced than he is at this point. But maybe it's possible. But it's only through a very, very, very conscientious level of effort that we can even approach that kind of a concept. I mean, it's just really a real effort to work. Let's take a 5-minute break. I've got to bail out of here at 5 minutes to 5 because I've got a guy from New York I've got to have dinner with tonight.
Dominate, and we haven't really done any interchange between us. On the previous discussion, anybody want to take issue with what I'm saying or tell me I'm full of it? You won't be the first, by the way. Is there anything that we've talked about that you'd like to probe a little bit from your own point of view? Yeah.
Why do you think that the best of both worlds is not yet possible?
That's really interesting. I did an interview for a guy in the Smithsonian magazine that's going to write a big article. It'll appear late this fall. And he says, if you could describe native leaders, what are they? And I said, they're scavengers of life, sifting through culture, picking out the nuggets. And that's really what we do. We really go through and we really try and pick up the best of each world. But that's a no-no. You get chastised for that. I mean, all you have to do is go to a whale hearing.
What do you mean you got TV up there and you're talking about cultural identity?
I mean, you know, you can't have both. You get, you know, they tell you you can only have one.
If you want to hunt whales, go use a spear, not an exploding bomb.
Yeah, you know. You ever chase a whale with a spear? It's tough.
I like my 243 repeating, Browning lever action with a
firepower scope or whatever.
But I don't think society will let us. I think if we were isolated to a greater extent, without the oil maybe, without the identity that the oil gives the state, and if the people here were allowed to seek their own level and there wasn't that tremendous economic influence in the state, I think maybe they could work it out. But I think that the dominant society, which, you know, let's call it like it is, it's white Anglo-America, is going to say more and more. They're going to say either or. Either or. You want houses? There's a mortgage. You know, either or. The legislation that we see today tends to support that. The baby legislation that's going on in the state now. You can't have a baby at home. I can hardly wait for him to get a surgeon over to Yuzinki. I just think that's great. They're making it more restrictive on the people all the time. And the native community is going to come under a tremendous amount of ostracism for sifting through culture and picking out the nuggets. They're going to get their hands slapped for hoarding. I think the next issue in the state is subsistence. That's the one that's going to divide the native community from the white community more than any other issue right now. And I think maybe it's our next 5 years. And it's a no-win issue, the way I see it. It's just a no-win. Sportsmen, commercial interests, and rural resident. And subsistence almost defines description. You know, it's such an impossible thing. But it's a very volatile issue as it relates to native, non-native. It kind of personifies the carefree individualism that America would like to be on one hand,
with what America perceives as the realities of the 80s or the industrial age that we're in today. And you're never going to convince an Oklahoma roughneck living in Kenai that he doesn't have as much right to a king salmon as a family of four living in Tione. You're never going to convince him of that. Never, ever going to convince him of that. And it's going to rip the state. No question in my mind, it's going to rip the state. It's going to be highly emotional. It's going to be tough. I hope very much that the regions don't get involved. But I suspect that they will. And we're going to have corporate money in there. We're going to have state subsidized money in there. And it's really going to be a nightmare. Really, really, really going to be a nightmare. Maybe more so than the success or failure of the corporate structures. Did I lock it?
Well, isn't the definition of the word itself part of the difficulty?
Oh, it's impossible, sure. It defies
the... So what are you talking... What are we talking about?
We're talking about... what we're really talking about is priority rights of resources. That's really what we're talking about. Who has more right or less right to fish and game? Now, I can assure you that my village will always take enough game to feed itself. Right, wrong, or indifferent. And maybe that's where the problem is the problem lies in the efforts to define the identity of the need for definition. I think that maybe if they just let it float and they have pretty good game enforcement officers that use a little common sense, you could probably skim over the problem for the next 20 years, and it would probably wash out someplace 25 or 30 years down the trail. But it isn't going to work that way. It just isn't going to work that way. Well, income's fine. An E3 on the Elmendorf Air Force Base doesn't make a hell of a lot of money.
I'm talking about most of the people in the village don't make quite a bit of money. I mean, just live off the
system. True. But it varies from year to year. Lifestyle is a little more consistent than income. Income is certainly an approach to go. Yeah, that's the way to go.
Like most of the neighbors that I've talked to about this, would rather not see it defined on race, but on rural versus non-rural.
Absolutely. People. That's the only logical way to go.
People living up in Wiseman, places up in the Brooks Range who are making a living, you know, they depend on that.
100% subsistence living, sure. But it will be a racial issue.
But it is a problem.
Because the people that can address the problem are the native corporations, the native villages, and the nonprofits, and they'll carry the cross, and they'll get the nails. But it will be a racial issue. And the guy, the demographics of the state being what they are, 50% of the population lives in Anchorage. I've been there 10 years, and I still can't figure out why. The nicest thing about Anchorage is it's not too far from Alaska. But, you know, that's that redneck guy living down on the Kenai who says it's that Indian across the river in Tyonic that's my problem. Pure and simple. And that's one of the biggest, the big fight now is that Cook Inlet king salmon.
What do you think of the chances of it being gone along?
Yeah, income is a reasonable approach, but it really doesn't address the problem. The problem is the need.
Well, what I'm saying is that Caucasians live out in the village, and there's a bunch of natives, and some of the natives
Sure.
And I think it's kind of bad to draw a line and say you can't, even though you've lived here and your children have lived here, you know. And you think he can because he's native. But yet this guy is more native than native true
I hunt. I've hunted all my life. I asked myself the other day whether I was a subsistence hunter or not.
And you know, it's hard to answer. I go home every year, and I take four deer and maybe three seals. And bring them home. Part of our food has been since I came home, and it was even I was to hunt with my grandmother. I was 19 before I got a legal deer.
But it's a hard question. It's a really hard question. Is that subsistence? Certainly. Certainly. I don't need four deer to subsist. You know?
Would you be satisfied with one?
I could use six. Four happens to be the bag limit. I usually take two caribou too on top of that, and we eat in my house about 70% game. And if I get a moose, which I don't hunt moose every year, mainly because it isn't in my area and I just didn't grow up on the meat, but I have on occasion taken a moose, and then I don't buy any meat. Is that subsistence?
No. It's like ANS. Should I have ANS privileges? Do I need ANS privileges? The truth of the matter is I can't get medical insurance that will carry over because I have a federal policy. ANS covers me. That's something all of you should be aware of. If you should get cancer or a major heart attack or anything like that, Blue Cross or any of the other insurance agents that you're a member of through your employer can refuse to pay because you have another policy. Federal policy. Should I spend money every month for medical insurance that I may or may not use, or may or may not have the privilege of using? You know, how?
What do you think of the idea of domesticating, like moose and stuff like that? I mean,
I don't think anything of it.
Well,
I never hear of it, but.
What I'm thinking about is that right now it's wildlife. I've been looking around the idea, and my grandfather was looking around the idea that you could domesticate them and raise them and make an economic base for some of the villages there.
That's interesting. Now, they've done some things with a thing called buffalo, or not buffalo, but beefalo, which is a cross between a buffalo, and it's a very good red meat animal. What I'm saying is the technology exists already, and it's not been utilized, which is a fascinating thing. To take a moose and domesticate it, I don't think it would make economic sense if you could take an animal that probably pound for pound is just as good such as the beefalo, or even the buffalo that's in Alaska.
There is places in Russia that have already done this, that have bred out the meat and the milk and a work moose. We have looked into this.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and so if you could, with probably you could bring one in and breed it out, you know, if it was possible.
I can see it now.
Yeah.
Just hold still and eat some milk. Don't
<Okay.
laughs> Yeah.
Dehorn.
Yeah. Tied down, trust. On a rail. Right.
Well, they have done it. It's hard to get information from them, but we've got little books and stuff like that from there in Switzerland who have also domesticated them.
The potential in Alaska is absolutely staggering. I mean, this is where it's at. The rest of the world was created to give us a lesson in appreciation. I mean, yeah, the potential here, you can talk in realms. Yeah, it's all right here. Great, great country. You can do all kinds of things.
What do you think of succeeding from the government? I've talked to people from Canada, some natives, and they think that we ought to join an ally and create a, you know.
I'll answer that honestly. If I thought there was a chance that Alaska could succeed from the Union, I would dedicate my life to it. However, the economics of energy in the next 35 years absolutely preclude Alaska.
Tried
it was tried in the 40s.
Uh-huh. Yeah, okay.
It's
just now the energy situation the way it is today, you just you know, every one of you
take a boarding student in, be a National Guardsman from Wichita. No, there's no way in the world America would ever even consider it, I don't think. Well, let's get on. We've got about 15, 20 minutes left. I was going to go into village corporate structure and some of the political ramifications. Is there anything else you'd like to cover in the 15 minutes or so? You want to just have a roundtable discussion about things or what? Well, feel free. If there's anything you want to ask about land claims, or
could you explain what will happen after 1981?
Sure. 1991. That's a really good question.
We're halfway through it now. We're 1981. In 1991, the stock will be alienable. Now, what that means is right now, I've got 100 shares of cognac. 100 shares of Yuzinki Native Village Corporation. I can't eat them, I can't give them away, I can't pledge them, I can't borrow against them, I can't sell them. There's nothing I can do unless I die, and then I can will them. That's the only control I have over the alienability of that stock. It's absolutely and totally worthless from the point of personal possession. This is where the old people really came up short. Really got ripped. In 1991, I will be able to do something with those shares. Maybe. There's an effort now to continue the alienability of those shares and put it out further. And there's a lot of mixed emotion among the high leadership about that. But in 91, technically I'll be able to sell my shares. We'll take my particular case. I come from a village that has about 73,000 acres of timber. My village corporation, very, very, very conservative. In fact, so conservatively, I'll quote it to you in 1977 dollars.
Boy, I tell you, I get on my knees every night and thank my grandmother for living in the right village. I can sell that 100 shares in 91. What'll it be worth? God only knows. If the corporation holds together and is managed reasonably well and the assets are there, you can do the multiplication and division yourself. Now, the regional shares change around dramatically.
We took all this land and we traded it in the D2 bill for a Fog Neck Island. And then we merged all the villages, with the exception of mine. And I had nothing to do with that, honestly. The regional shares may be close to that. Could conceivably be close to that. We've got a well over here, got an oil well that's being drilled now in Yantarni Bay. We own 1% of Challenger Island plus 6 or 7 other Beaufort Sea leases. The company's healthy. Who knows what it's worth?
The interesting thing is what happens.
Let's take a worst side scenario. First of all, these corporations are unique because everybody's an equal shareholder. Normal corporate situation, you got minority shareholders, and then you've got 4 or 5 majority shareholders that
really call the shots. None of that exists here. So for a period of time after 91, there's going to be a flutter and a settling out. There's going to be takeovers of the corporations.
There's going to be companies come in and pirate the shares.
Now, you can do some numbers here, and you can play with this. You can come up with a bottom line, but I'll tell you what the bottom line is. A 44-foot Hansen Saner. You want to get right down to it? There isn't a Nate on Kodiak Island, myself included, who wouldn't trade his shares for a 44-foot Hansen. That's what we know. That's a Saner. It's worth X number of dollars right now. It's probably worth a couple hundred thousand. There's not a native in my village, not a fisherman there, that wouldn't trade his shares for that Saner. Your Exxon, your SoCal, you got a lease with this company. Maybe you want to take it over. Be good business. How much of a corporation do you have to own that's equally split out before you control it? At any given election, any annual meeting, take a note. In fact, Doyon just had their election. You can get the numbers here in town. Go down there at Baltimore, find out what percentage of the outstanding shares voted. And you'll find that the outstanding shares voting usually runs anywhere from 60 down to 52, someplace there. Okay? How much of that company do you have to own now? Cuts it down pretty small. You only have to own maybe 20-30% of the company to control everything. But you know, on any given issue, in a board meeting, you're going to get some support. So you calculate that if you do some good PR and some good manipulation, you can control 20% of the voting shares on an issue. That's not unreasonable. You take 20% off of that, that's all you have to own to control a company.
That's among sleepy shareholders.
No, there's no such thing really as sleepy shareholders. If you look at traditional corporate activity of any large corporation, you'll find that that's very, very much in the ballpark. Very much. It's very, very expensive to hold an annual meeting. It's very, very, very expensive to educate. Very expensive to communicate. Okay, on one issue, 1 year, you run up the activity to all the way to 72%. And the next year it goes down. Now, you can control the company right there. Very, very, very comfortably. Very, very comfortably. And after all, we're talking about shareholders that are not traditional shareholders in the true sense of investment. And not only that, they've just come through 20 years. 20 years is a block of activity. There ain't a hell of a lot that's going to excite them in the 21st, 22nd, 23rd year.
Eric, what kind of structure would be capable of absorbing those shares that are alienable, given the provision in the U2 bill that says the regional corporation has the worst choice, worst right to buy?
First right is only as good as your treasury. I mean, yeah, I might be able to, in Koniag, if you plan for it, and you set up some sinking funds and some liquid investments and some options on some liquidities, and you sold some preferred stock, you could raise, and you might be able to stave off one or maybe two attempts at your company. Third time around, I don't think you can do it. And after all, if another company wants to buy you out, isn't that a mark of success? You must have something. You got good dividends, you got good assets, you don't have a lot of problems. Beautiful opportunity to take over a company. There's some argument on that.
They're trying to say that only natives can vote shares. It's not in the original act, except that as it relates to the 20 years. There are non-native shareholders right now of record through inheritance, and you're going to get into corporate problems very quick, very, very, very quick. SEC, I think, is going to step in. I don't hold a lot of hope for that, and I'm not sure I want to see that happen either. After all, let's just run this out. Guy sells his shares. What has he done? Damn it, hasn't he sold off his identity? Hasn't he sold off his nativism? Hasn't he really crossed his family? Has he? Or has he? Worked all his life? He's 68 years old. Mama just passed away. Kids are all gone. Got an asset? Got a bum leg? Needs some warm weather? Hasn't he got a right to liquidate? It's his. Can you really ostracize that man? What about the guy who's got 100 shares, 6 kids, all born after the Land Claims Act? He's got no limited entry permit. He's been a boat puller all his life on a seiner. Now he has the capability to become economically independent by selling those shares, buying that 44-foot seiner, and a permit. You're going to tell me he's wrong?
If I've done my job right as treasurer of Koniag, he'll get a great price for those. Isn't that my job, to make sure that when he gets ready to sell, that he gets the absolute top dollar, because for 20 years that company's been successful?
Tough trade. Really tough trade.